Thank you for joining us. I'm Scott Atlas. Welcome to The Independent, my show that tries to bring a rational perspective to some of the more complicated issues facing society today. Today's guest is Gad Saad. He's a professor of marketing at Concordia University in Montreal and is serving as a visiting professor at Northwood University. Professor Saad has pioneered the use of evolutionary psychology in marketing and consumer behavior. His works include several books and published papers, many at the intersection of psychology with advertising, medicine, and economics. He's also working on a new book, Suicidal Empathy, which follows the 2020 release of his previous bestseller, The Parasitic Mind, How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense. His YouTube channel and podcast, both called The Saad Truth, S-A-A-D, have garnered millions of views. Gad and I have a conversation about what he sees today and how he explains the behavior and thinking of the public, especially young adults, and relates it to what might come next in the interplay between the media, universities, politics, and public behavior. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, Gad Saad, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Oh, it's so good to be with you. I can't believe it's been more than 2 years since the Global Liberty Institute in Florida. So great to be with you, Scott. Thank you.
Right. And that you were at the first of that meeting, which, of course, as you know, is intended to think not just short term. And we'll talk about this because this is a generational issue and educating and emboldening people to think independently. And I think that's sort of the topic of what this whole discussion will be. I'll start by saying you are a scholar in human behavior. That's the way I look at it. And specifically on how people's thinking is influenced, whether in marketing or in actual thought. And you've moved to take that concept and put it into this very, very important book you wrote in 2020 called The Parasitic Mind, How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense. And it's based upon your concept that ideas, ideologies are serving as infectious ideas. They're infections, they're pathogens. I'd like you to explain that for the audience.
Sure. Thanks for that question, Scott. So as I was trying to come up with a framework to explain how it is that people could be so irrational in their folk psychology, in their worldviews, I started to scour through the animal literature. So at first I, you know, looked at the field of parasitology, which simply looks at parasite-host interactions. But a tapeworm could be a parasite that parasitizes your intestinal tract. But neuroparasitology is a subfield of parasitology where the parasite ultimately ends up going to the host's brain, altering its circuitry to suit its reproductive interests. So, example, a wood cricket, an actual wood cricket, abhors water. It wants nothing to do with water. But when it is parasitized by a neuroparasite that's called a hairworm, the hairworm needs the wood cricket to go into water so that it could complete its reproductive cycle. So the wood cricket will merrily jump into the water, commit suicide in the service of the neuroparasite that has hijacked its brain. And so that was my epiphany. Aha, I will now use the neuroparasitological framework to argue that human beings could not only be parasitized by actual brain worms, Toxoplasma gondii is one, but they could be parasitized by idea pathogens, hence the parasitic mind.
Sure. So the idea pathogens that you talk about, and I think we're all aware of these if you start thinking it with that framework, what you called radical feminism, postmodernism, etc. And your key point here, at least in my reading, is that these things are really stemming from academia. Okay. I mean, this, and you and I are part of academia, of course. And, you know, we were all raised probably like everybody else. I'm making the assumption, you know, we have a lot of respect for academia, for universities, for professors. But the origin of these so-called mind viruses, and this is sort of a, you know, that's the concept, is the university.
Indeed.
Tell me how you came from that to that and why that's such a problem, of course.
Right. So my first, if you like, academic exposure to these parasitic ideas was in the pursuit of my scientific work, where I was trying to Darwinize the behavioral sciences. What does that mean? Most psychologists, most behavioral scientists study human behavior without ever invoking the biological and evolutionary roots of why we behave the way that we do. Why do we have the emotions that we do? Why is our cognitive system structured the way that it is? And so in my first semester as a doctoral student at Cornell, I had taken an advanced social psychology course, and about halfway through the semester, the professor had assigned a book called Homicide, which is probably the book that most altered my sort of intellectual life. The book was written by a husband and wife team, two pioneers of evolutionary psychology, where they were arguing that certain patterns of criminality occur around the world and across time periods in exactly the same way because of evolutionary reasons. Now, when I saw the elegance, the theoretical elegance, the theoretical parsimony with which evolutionary theory was able to explain complex human behaviors, that's when I decided, okay, well, I'm going to take that framework and I'm going to apply it to the behavioral fields that interest me. And I thought that's pretty banal. I mean, of course, human beings are biological beings. You're a physician. You know that we are biological beings. But apparently my colleagues in the social sciences and in the business school and in economics departments thought that I was insane. Surely, according to them, biology matters for every species on Earth, except human beings. And if we are going to afford the courtesy of applying evolutionary psychology or evolutionary theory to human beings, it should stop at the neck. So sure, we could explain why we have opposable thumbs according to evolutionary theory, but surely, Dr. Saad, you're not one of those quack Nazis that thinks the most important organ in your body called your brain is prone to the forces of evolution. Yes, I do think that. And so that was my first exposure to how perfectly, supposedly reasonable academics could be parasitized by absolute nonsense. So that was my first exposure very early. So I finished my PhD in 1994, so 31 years ago. And then over the next 31 years, I just saw this incessant war on reason, where I would be sitting in meetings where I am evaluating grants to decide whether to grant that grant or not. And it's, you know, queer glaciology and, you know, feminist mathematics and all the nonsense. And so, you know, it's been a long exposure to this war on reason, which then led me to write The Parasitic Mind.
Yeah, I think you're sort of pointing out a couple of things that are interesting to me. Number one, we've seen this happen, people in our age bracket, for decades. This is not a sudden phenomenon. And so that's sort of a point to consider. This is a gradual process that has occurred and been on campus, frankly, for decades, while most of us were not paying attention to what was happening, really. But the second part is we're talking about it now, suddenly, more than ever before. And I actually, my contention is it's because of what happened during the pandemic, because the pandemic exposed things. It wasn't that it created anything. It exposed in a very personal way. We were all affected in one way or another, some people very severely with their families, and people died and their kids have severe psychological problems. But others of us were just watching this unfold with horror. And so I think this really put it front and center. And this is sort of, in a funny way or a strange way, the silver lining of the pandemic was that it finally forced the issue to be confronted. That's how I view it. So we're sitting here and we're looking at this happening on campus. Okay, so you sort of identified, you said this sort of infestation, this distortion of thinking among the university professors themselves in your meetings. But what's happened is that these people are so credible in society, like I mentioned, right? We're all raised to respect them. Our kids, my own kids personally, they were taught really, okay, listen to the professor. Society uses professors, as you know, as our experts. That is the sort of expert class in many ways. And so now we've given these people such credibility that they are very able to transmit these strange, illogical ideas to our own children, who are obviously the next leaders of society.
Right. So two points to make. Number one, while I agree with you that certainly COVID crystallized a lot of the lunacy, but to use your COVID example, in the same way that we now, most of us agree that it was a lab leak theory. So the virus starts off at the Wuhan lab, but it eventually escapes. The exact same corollary happens with bad ideas. The reason why many people were not paying attention, including within the academic class, because their reaction to me when I would be standing on top of the mountain and screaming and warning people was, but come on, Gad, that's just some esoteric stupidity in some humanities. And I hate to be the guy who says, I told you so. I would tell them, but guess what? It'll break out of the humanities. Eventually, it will become our last prime minister called Justin Trudeau, who is a walking manifestation of every parasitic idea and every reflex of suicidal empathy that I've spent decades talking about. And so yes, at first, it seems as though it is restricted to a small microcosm, but you know that pathogens eventually escape. So that's number one. Yeah. The other thing I would say regarding your point about the authority and so-called expertise of professors, there's actually a very interesting psychological phenomenon here, Scott. So in one of the most beautiful social psychological phenomena that I learned of early in my PhD was something called the fundamental attribution error. So, you know, how do you attribute things in your life? And many of us, it's called the self-serving bias. We attribute successes internally and failures externally, right? I did well on the exam because I'm smart. I did very poorly on the exam because Professor Atlas is a mean jerk, okay?
Right. Now, sounds familiar, by the way. Go ahead.
I faced that sentiment myself many times. Now, imagine a postmodernist professor stands up and starts espousing the endless nihilistic gibberish that is completely nonsensical. Now, the average audience member is faced with two possible options. Either they say that the guy who is espousing this stuff must be so profound that I'm simply too dumb to understand it, or they will say he's espousing bullshit and I see through him. Now, regrettably, there's the cognitive sleight of hand. Most students will say it's because I'm too dumb. Mm-hmm. And therefore, Jacques Derrida and Jacques Lacan and Michel Foucault and all of the rest of the bullshitters, I hope I can say that word, all of the French postmodernists and so on, can get away with what they're doing because they realize the frailty of the human condition, which is I am the fancy professor standing on top of the podium at Princeton. Surely I can't be espousing nonsense. And we all nod and say, oh, yes, professor, you're very fancy.
Right. I mean, part of this really is not just the respect that society has for the scholarly, learned professors. And by the way, as you know well, this is not just a Western society construct. This is, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've traveled and I've traveled as a visiting professor in places like India or Southeast Asia and China. You know, you're revered as a professor, perhaps even more, I think probably more so than in places like the United States or Canada. But there's also the intimidation factor that even leaders have. It's not just students. And this is something that I saw, and I think it's very true, that when you have people in power, whether it's a prime minister or a president, they're generally laymen. I'll use that term, not in a critical way, but that's a literal way in terms of, particularly when things like that are scientific or in your field of psychology and in medical science and all of these areas where they are intimidated, because partly we are taught as young people that, okay, these people must know this knowledge is esoteric, right? So they defer, and society does this quite a bit. And I think this is one of the problems with people not being independent thinking. It's not just that they're not independent thinkers. It's simply that, okay, they're intimidated by people who, quote, have the credentials.
Agreed.
And I actually think, and I'd like to hear your thought on this, one of the things I hope is that the era of trusting people based solely on their credential must be over. We need to be critical thinkers.
I agree. And that's why I abhor whenever, you know, I interact with all sorts of people on social media. I don't care how many followers you have. If I think that whatever you're posting is worthy of an interaction, I will interact with you. And oftentimes, I'll see people say, you know, whatever, pediatrician here, which is kind of the start, right? I've never said, you know, Professor Dr. Gatzad, BSc, MBA, MS, PhD, Cornell here, right? I mean, you judge me based on the veracity of my ideas. If my ideas stand the test, the sniff test, the ecological test, the theoretical test, then it's worthy. By the way, it's interesting that you talk about sort of that kind of ivory tower. We are the, you know, to use Thomas Sowell's
sure,
the anointed ones, right? I was, and I hate to say this, Scott, I know you were at Stanford, but in the first chapter of The Parasitic Mind, I talk about a incident that happened at Stanford. I had been invited to Stanford Business School, which certainly is one of the meccas of academia, to give a talk on sort of my evolutionary psychology research, how I apply it to consumer behavior, to economic decision-making. And the gentleman who took me out the night before my talk the next day was himself a professor at Stanford Business School. And as we sat down to have dinner, he looked at me and said, oh, you know, I was doing sort of a deep dive to kind of get a better sense of your profile. Oh, I didn't know you know, you had been on Joe Rogan so many times. I said, oh, yeah, many times. He goes, yeah, well, you know, and I'm going to try to put on the smug, arrogant, elitist face that he used. He goes, yeah, well, you know, at Stanford, we don't condone that. I said, you don't condone
that. By the way, I've seen that smug, arrogant face many times at Stanford and elsewhere, by the way, but
exactly.
Go ahead.
And I said, you don't condone what at Stanford exactly? He goes, well, we don't do our research so it could be sexy enough so that we can go on Joe Rogan's show. I said, well, I don't do that either. But, and here's where there was a chill for the rest of the evening, because I retorted with a classic gadism. I said, well, isn't it better to do valuable research and then go in front of 20 million people and try to excite them about the research that you're doing rather than publishing your research in a peer-reviewed paper that will be read by the editor, the two reviewers, and your mom? And he just went cold, right? Now, again, I'm not denigrating, and I'm sure you're not either, the power and the value of peer-reviewed papers. But shouldn't it be part of our professional responsibility to excite the public about the hopefully cool things that we do? Well, according to Stanford and Cornell and all of the anointed ones, no, we only speak to each other. We don't talk to the great unwashed.
Right. And this is your concept as well as mine, that you wrote, it takes haughty, I'm quoting here, it takes haughty professors decoupled from reality within the walls of their ivory tower to come up with some of the most imbecilic ideas imaginable. And that is, that's so true. And it's been said in different ways, really, over the history by a lot of people, but it reminds
Orwell,
me of...
Orwell said something along those lines. Yeah.
Right. You know, it reminds me of a cartoon I once saw of people toasting at a PhD postdoc party to someone who was just awarded the PhD. And the toast was, and may our research never be practical, you know, never be used. I mean, there's sort of this reverse snobbery kind of thing going on about the, about that. But I want to talk about something that's a very important concept to all of the things that you've elucidated, which is this idea of misplaced empathy. Okay, yes. This is in your fourth, you're writing another book, which is called Suicidal Empathy, to examine this, which I want to mention for the viewers. But this whole concept of misplaced empathy, it's sort of tied in with guilt-ridden behavior. Could you give us the explanation of this?
Yes, thank you for that question. So let me kind of give the background. So take, for example, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. You can study OCD actually from an evolutionary perspective in the following way, and I'll link it in a second to how I came up with the framework for suicidal empathy.
Okay.
The idea that we should scan the environment for environmental threats makes perfect evolutionary sense. It makes perfect adaptive sense, right? So if I see you at a party, Scott, and I notice that you sneezed into your hand, then you go out to shake my hand, then I'm going to very quietly, after we shake hands, go to the bathroom and wash my hands because I don't want to catch your flu. That makes perfect evolutionary sense. The fact that I go to the back door of our house, make sure that it's locked, makes perfect adaptive sense. The problem arises when the scanning of the threat becomes hyperactive. So what happens to an OCD person? The warning flag goes up, you tend to it, and then the warning flag goes up again, and now you're stuck in an infinite loop of checking. So if you suffer from germ contamination OCD, you spend 8 hours cleaning your hands in scalding hot water, you don't make it to work, so you get fired, your skin is starting to fall off because you're washing it for 8 hours, right? So what began as an adaptive process becomes maladaptive when, in this case, it hyperfires. And so when I had that framework, I said, aha, that's exactly what I'm going to argue for empathy. Empathy is a very noble emotion to have. It actually oils our sociality, right? So, for example, part of empathy is having theory of mind, right? Putting yourself in the mind of another. We know, for example, that autistic children, one of the ways that we diagnose them as being autistic is they fail a theory of mind task. They can't put themselves in the mind of another, which is one of the symptoms or one of the manifestations of autism. So empathy is great as long as it is within certain regulated zones. It's applied to the right target at the right time and the right amount, which, by the way, Aristotle explained that to us several thousand years ago when he talked about the golden mean. Too little of something is not good, too much of something is not good, and much of life is finding that middle sweet spot. And so right. I put all those together and I said, aha, that's exactly what we're seeing right now. Misguided, misplaced, orgiastic, weaponized suicidal empathy. Therefore, MS-13 gang members are way more worthy of our empathy than American vets who've lost limbs, if not their lives, fighting for the United States, right?
Or even the victims of the gang members themselves, direct sense.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you don't want to put this, especially if, let's say, he's a person, a criminal of color. I mean, he's already been victimized by the society, the white supremacist society that drove
that drove him
to criminality. Now you're going to double whammy him by putting him within the penal racist justice system. That's not nice. And so what I do in the book is I look at all of the astoundingly disastrous, both domestic and foreign policies, and I argue they are all rooted in this suicidal empathy.
Yeah, so I think a big one that has been in the news quite a bit that everyone's familiar with is the somehow hyper concern with the rights of some people to the point where it totally destroys the rights of the other people, including in a dangerous way. And my example that I'm thinking of here is if I would talk about the trans issue with sports. Okay, it's one thing to start talking about, okay, trans biological men who are now considering themselves women, they want to compete in sports. It's not just actually, although partly it's the opportunity lost to the biological women in the sports, because the fact is, as nature, as all biology knows, biological men have physical attributes that are beneficial in sports over biological women. That's just not even arguable to be opposed to that idea. But the second part is that even to force women, young girls, to allow biological men in their locker rooms, in their showers. Okay. And I think this is a great example of what you're talking about, where yes, we care about the well-being and the rights of everyone, but at some point this is already completely irrational to go to the extreme of insisting that the rights of biological males override any rights, including privacy and personal security, of girls.
Exactly. And so couple of things to answer. Number one, you can go to my YouTube channel and search GADSAD Canadian Senate. In 2017, I was summoned in front of the Canadian Senate, what was then a bill that was tabled, that was being discussed. It has since passed, called Bill C-16, which of course, famously, Jordan Peterson also tried to fight. And if you listen to my testimony, again, I hate to be the guy to say, I told you so, but I told you so. I exactly predicted every single thing that came down the line. I called it the tyranny of the minority, right? I said, look, It is perfectly reasonable to expect that all people should live in a world that is free of, you know, endemic bigotry. That's great. Sign me up for that. But in the pursuit of that laudable goal, we don't rape and murder truth to achieve that, right? So we don't all, you know, nod our heads and go, yes, yes, of course, men can menstruate. Yes, yes, of course, men too can bear children, right? Yes, yes, of course, we're going to call women cervix havers. That's literally true. Cervix havers, because women, really, there's no, we don't know what is a phenotype of a woman. So until about 15 minutes ago, the 117 billion people that had existed on Earth, that's an actual estimate, were able to fully navigate through the very difficult conundrum of finding out who is male or female. But 15 minutes ago, we lost the ability to do that. So that's point one. Point two, The idea that we should met out our investments in an evolutionarily strategic way is, again, foundational to evolutionary theory. So for example, I am much more likely to jump in front of a moving bus to save my own biological child than I am to save a random person, not because I'm a callous and mean person, but because you would expect that my emotional, cognitive, and behavioral systems would have evolved in such a way that it confers upon me some evolutionary advantage. I would like to save the random person, but if given the choice, I'm more likely to save my biological child. Now, why am I saying that? Because it speaks to how you met out your empathy gas tank, right? Yes, I want to be empathetic to the 1 in 10,000 transgender people who may or may not be facing bigotry, but not at the expense of the empathy that is owed to all biological women, to your point, right? Right? The calculus right. that is within our brain has to make evolutionary sense. Suicidal empathy eradicates all that.
But how do we... You know, this idea of this very bizarre empathy, which I have a couple of sort of random thoughts about it. Number one, it's so irrational. I'm not even ready to accept that it's sincere, even by the people who espouse it. I'm not sure, because you get to this issue of virtue signaling. There's a secondary gain here. And again, I'm not a psychologist, but, as my father used to say, a keen observer of the human condition. He said that jokingly. But, you know, it is true that people get secondary gain from showing empathy, from even if it's pretend empathy. And I don't know where I'd like to hear if you think that's going on here.
I think there's definitely some of that. I think some of it is, you know, vacuous, fatuous, you know, virtue signaling. But some of it, I think, and hence the parasitic nature, right? That's why the wood cricket jumps in the water, not virtue signaling his suicide. He literally commits suicide, because you are altering people's value systems in a way where nothing becomes more important, right? So to use the term of operations research, which is a field of applied mathematics, where you try to use algorithms to solve some optimization problem, the ultimate value that they are seeking to optimize is signaling, to your point in a sense, how good people they are. They're tolerant, they're kind, they're compassionate in lieu of any other conflicting value, right? So, and let me give you
when it shows that they're actually not,
even when
all exactly, those things.
Exactly right. So here's a fantastic example, and my forthcoming book has a million of those. There is a Norwegian man who was raped by so this is a male who was sodomized by a Somali immigrant to Norway. Of course, Norway is very kind, is very empathetic. They don't believe in harsh penalties. And so after a very, very short, you know, laughable sentence, they were going to deport the Somali sodomizer. The victim of the rape is such a good and kind person that he felt very guilty. Earlier, you mentioned guilt. He felt very guilty and torn and hurt that this guy, if he ends up going to Somalia, will not be able to, you know, maximally flourish. He's not going to ascend to Maslow's, you know, self-actualization, apex of actualization. He didn't use those words, but I'm adding it to it. Now, I'm here to tell you as an evolutionary psychologist that the human emotional system did not evolve to feel sympathy and empathy for the one who sodomized you. But see, he has transcended those material, biological realities that keep you and I grounded to this. He's at a higher spiritual plane. He forgives his sodomizer. It's insane. Exactly to your point. It's irrational.
Yeah. I mean, you have to... A part of me always says what's dangerous is these people actually believe what they're saying. Even though it defies all common sense. The second part, I want to take a little diversion here and talk about something else, which is in the field of how this works in advertising specifically. And this is one of my, I think, biggest sort of, I'm totally disgusted by the advertising world combining with this idea of infecting somebody's brain into some bizarre sort of empathy. And that is the glamorization that we've seen, particularly in the United States, but elsewhere, of obesity. Okay, this has been going on for 20 years. You know, my experience going or walking around Lower Manhattan and Soho, where they have these big billboards of advertising for years, for 15, 20 years, we have seen, and on the covers of women's fashion magazines, the new healthy, the new beautiful, and it's these morbidly obese people. And it's just it's a shocking abuse of the public by people who think that they're nicer people because, oh, we're trying to say that you shouldn't be discriminating against obesity. And I think this has a real significant health impact because it portrays obesity as good. It's not good. It's very bad. It's the worst possible thing pretty much that you can do for your health.
You're predicting or you're foretelling one of the sections in suicidal empathy where I get into the body positivity as a form of misplaced empathy, right? But it speaks to my earlier point about which objective function you're trying to maximize, right? You're a physician. You obviously know first do no harm, but now do no harm on which metric? Now, you would understand it as, well, there is quite incontrovertible evidence that all things equal, being 80 pounds overweight is probably not a good thing. But how about if I were to rearrange your objective function that you're trying to maximize, whereby I say the most important function to maximize is the sense of self-esteem of your patient? In that case, you're now in a bit of a quandary. Should you tell your patient that there is unbelievable amount of evidence that suggests that you're probably going to die early if you're 80 pounds overweight? Or should you say, you go, girl, healthy at any weight? Well, if you've been parasitized by suicidal empathy, the latter is the way for you to go. So throw away your Hippocratic oath, manage people's self-esteem.
As part of this sort of parasitization of what you're thinking, really, it's not just teaching it. It's not just the advertising. It's also there's a negative. There's a there's a cancel culture that people have to face. So I think particularly young people, okay, people like perhaps you and I don't care as much what people think of us, or wouldn't be so outspoken. But we know we're pretty comfortable, not just in our own skin, but we have a social structure. Whereas younger people, understandably, and here I'm being empathetic, understandably care a lot about what their friends and their social world thinks. They're growing up. And I do understand that. But this cancel culture is very effective, I think. And I wonder what you think about that and what role that's playing in sort of making people have these totally irrational, really, senses of where empathy should be.
Great question. And I hope you'll appreciate my answer, although it might sound slightly harsh in terms of the exacting code of conduct by which I abide. I care a lot less about what other people think of me as compared to what I think of me, meaning that I am my harshest critic, and therefore I set my code of conduct to be so exacting that I will never walk away from the defense of the truth in the service of managing the impression that other people have of me. Because, Scott, when I put my head on the pillow to go to bed at night, I can't go to sleep, and I will suffer from insomnia, and I'll have to come to Dr. Scott Atlas to help me with my insomnia, because I will feel as though I were a fraud. I'm a charlatan. How could I be?
I couldn't agree more with you. You know, this is, of course, I think we're very simpatico with this kind of stuff. I mean, personally, I don't know how these people look at themselves in the mirror. The people that, in my case, the lockdowners, the people at Stanford University who refused to admit they were wrong and refused to admit I and others were right. I don't know how they can look at themselves. I don't know how they can look at their children.
Can I tell you how they do it? So there is, and I feel as though I should getting like some kind of cut of their royalties if all of my promotion of their book is causing an increase in sales. There's a book that was written by two French psychologists, cognitive psychologists, one of whom has been on my show. It's Hugo Mercier and Dan Sperber. They wrote a book called The Enigma of Reason. And they argued very provocatively, but very convincingly in my view, that the faculty of reasoning, human reasoning, did not evolve to seek some objective truth, but rather to win arguments, right? Now, that's a very disheartening, you know, insight to have, because what that basically says is most people don't care about the truth. Most people care about winning arguments. So your Stanford colleagues are never going to come and say, you know, in light of the incoming evidence, I now concede that Scott or Jay were right. I would rather die before I ever accept that. So in our utopian epistemological view, we think that all professors are simply pursuing truth. No, they're pursuing the objective of winning arguments. So you're going to be waiting a long time before they send you that apology letter, Scott.
Yeah, I'm not anticipating one, but you know, I do really feel it's sort of something we have to reconcile as a society, that these people will not admit they were wrong. They will not accept fact. They will not talk about what the evidence shows. And now we have to figure out how to move forward when you have a society like that, because we're literally living in a society where facts don't carry the day. Yeah. Facts don't matter. And I think that's a very cynical sort of message, but I am grappling with how we move forward. How do we get closure, particularly again from the pandemic, where millions of people were killed from the wrong policy? Children were cutting their wrists, were killing themselves, have severe psychological damage. We shifted the burden to the poor. All these grossly unethical and immoral things were done. And yet half of the country or whatever will just simply, they want to turn the page. They want to just forget it. They will never admit they were wrong.
I mean, I do have in chapter 7 of The Parasitic Mind, the chapter is titled How to Seek Truth. I do offer a methodology for demonstrating to even your staunchest detractors the veracity of your position. Now, if they go, la, 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 I don't want to hear it, then they are impervious to anything I might present. But as long as they grant me the courtesy to at least lay out the arguments, I do have a way of doing that. Would you like me to share?
Sure, absolutely.
So there is a thing that I call nomological networks of cumulative evidence, which is a mouthful, but it basically means that when you are trying to demonstrate the veracity of a position you're taking, what if I get you data from across cultures, across time periods, across species, across methodologies, all of which triangulate to demonstrating that my position is correct? Now, it's a lot more than a literature review. It's much broader. It's a lot more than a meta-analysis. Meta-analyses are much more pointed to a specific relationship between a couple of variables. This is an epistemological, chainsaw. So let me give a concrete example. Let's suppose, Scott, that you were a social scientist who argued, as do most social scientists, that toy preferences are socially constructed. So the reason why little boys prefer certain types of toys and little girls prefer other types of toys is because of social construction. And I want to come and prove to you that no, there is a universality to the sex specificity of toy preferences that is due to biology. How would I go about doing that? Okay, so now I'm going to build a partial nomological network to show you that. Okay, you with me?
Okay. Yes. So
I can get you data from developmental psychology showing you that children who are too young to yet be socialized. So by definition, they could not have been socialized. They haven't reached that cognitive developmental stage. They're already exhibiting those sex-specific toy preferences. That's a pretty incontrovertible piece of evidence. But I'm not going to stop there. I can get you data from rhesus monkeys and vervet monkeys and chimpanzees showing you that their infants exhibit the exact same sex-specific toy preferences as we do. I can get you data from other cultures that are completely non-Western, sub-Saharan Africa, showing you that they exhibit the same sex-specific toy preferences. I'll just do two more, but the network is actually much bigger. I can get you data from 2,500 years ago in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, where on funerary monuments, on mausoleums, little boys and girls are depicted playing with exactly the same types of toys as today. And I'll get you one more, if only because you're from medicine. I can get you data from pediatric endocrinology showing you that little girls who suffer from congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which is a disorder that masculinizes little girls' behaviors and morphologies, girls who suffer from this disorder have the exact sex-specific reversal of their toy preferences. So look what I did. I got you data from across cultures, from developmental psychology, from across species, from across time periods, and so on, all of which triangulate to the incontrovertible nature of the position that I'm taking. Now, you earlier mentioned cancel culture, so let me now close out by going back to cancel culture. Many people ask me, how is it that you're undoubtedly probably the most outspoken professor by orders of magnitude, and yet you're not canceled? Well, there are several reasons for that. One of which is that I have very, very well-regulated epistemic humility. When I know something, I walk with someone who's got all the swagger of having built my nomological network. Good luck if you want to debate me. But when I don't know something, I'm the first to say, hey, Scott, that's a great question. Unfortunately, it's out of my area of expertise. It's above my pay grade. So I don't try to wing it. And what that does is you could never catch me. I've been on Joe Rogan a million times. There is, 30, 40 hours of content, yet you've never caught me with my quote, proverbial pants down, because I never bullshit. I exactly know what I know and what I don't know. And so I think if people can have that epistemological discipline, we could have a society more built on truth and less on emotional incontinence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's very important, no doubt. When things get crazy, I think people drop that, though. Part of it is, like, for instance, in the pandemic, where people, the fear, there were a lot of emotions. It wasn't just an argument. It was something bigger. But I think the second reason that you don't get canceled is that you're not going to allow yourself to be canceled. I mean, I think that, and you know, this is really a fundamental point that I'm sure you probably agree, is that we need to speak out for truth. We can't have an ethical society without the truth being spoken. But more importantly, in a funny way, is that the value of speaking out is that you facilitate other people speaking out. Not everybody has to be the tip of the spear, but we need some tips of spears.
Yeah.
And when you do that, and people have said this to me many times, I'm sure you've been told, one of the most important things you've ever done is speak out for things that other people agree with, but they're not necessarily comfortable or they're afraid to speak out. When they hear you speak out, they say, well, yes, I agree with that. I think there's a very important part of having the courage to speak out. And, you know, you're certainly one of those people. I want to talk a few minutes about sort of the Trump election. Now, I view the Trump election, I think everybody does who's following this, as a repudiation of failed policies. I think this was a policy election, you know, whether it's the economy or rampant crime, international instability that we all saw happen under the Biden administration. But there's something more, and it's hard to quantify if it was that impactful, but it's what I call sort of a reaction of what I call cultural perversions that defy common sense. You know, girls should be forced to allow biological men in their locker rooms. Anybody, if you're a parent of a daughter, I don't know how you would tolerate that. I have sons, but it's so obvious to me. Or that biological men want to be in a women's prison, even though they're a rapist. I mean, you know, because they're going to say they're a woman. You know, how do you view the awakening, I'll call it, of at least the American voter? Why did that happen? Because, okay, this sort of, I mean, it took something to change this, to awaken people. Maybe it was not the cultural stuff at all. I don't know. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. And then I want to talk about a concern I have, which is I sense that there's a lot of people that think, okay, Trump won, now we're done, problem solved. There's almost a very premature sort of complacency going on. But that's the second part. First, I want to hear your views on what it means that Trump was elected.
Well, I think you're right on both points. I think that, you know, most decent people are tired of feeling insecure about whether they can say that only women menstruate. I mean, let me give you a very specific example. Mm-hmm. I receive emails from ostensibly functioning adults who write to me the following email. Dear Professor Saad, you know, I know that you are an evolutionary behavioral scientist who studied sex differences, blah, blah, blah. I mean, does science now consider it that, you know, men can menstruate? Now imagine on the shaky grounds you're on in terms of, to use the term that everybody uses now, in terms of gaslighting, that you need to write me to receive my imprimatur to something that the average 3-day-old squirrel would otherwise know, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the trick that has taken place over the past 50 to 100 years with all of these parasitic ideas infecting our minds, where I no longer what up is down, left is right, men are women, slavery is freedom, and so on. And so most people woke up one day, I mean, it takes some tipping point, and said, like, I've had enough. I've had enough of going to DEI things where I'm told that I'm a disgusting white heterosexual male. I've had enough, and I'm voting for whichever candidate, you know, frees me of that nonsense. So your first point is certainly true. But I really love your second question, because I've been exactly warning against. I mean, I literally started warning about this the day after Trump won. Yes, I was mm-hmm. elated as a Canadian that Trump had won, because the alternative would have been that much more disastrous. But I kept saying to anybody who would listen to me, don't rest on your laurels. It took 50 to 100 years for these disastrous ideas to flourish and become part of accepted society. we're not going to eradicate this by 4-year term of Trump. Yes, he's an important doorstop. The opposite would have been disastrous, but it's a long battle. Now, I'd like to think that it won't take 50 to 100 years to develop the vaccine against all these parasitic ideas, but it's not going to start and end with Trump. I completely agree with you, Scott.
Yeah, and I think part of the issue is that, in my view, there's this idea of turning the page on what I consider the most heinous abusive leadership in our lifetimes, which was the pandemic lockdowns. And it's not that everything is about the pandemic, but it's that, again, the exposure of unbridled power and the people's acquiescence, which I think was even more shocking to me. But if we turn the page on these things and just assume, okay, we're done, we fixed it, Trump is elected or whatever, we have people that are going to repeal some of these healthcare things or add transparency or whatever, I think that we eliminate the closure that is needed for people, A, who lost their family, whose older parent died and they were forbidden from seeing them, whose child killed himself, who became the hundreds of millions of people who are thrown into abject poverty in the world, all these things. We need a closure of recognizing truth. But secondly, that eliminates all accountability to those in power. If we just turn the page, we don't want to talk about it. It's uncomfortable, so we're not going to go through that. And I think I don't know about the psychology of turning the page, because it is easier to not talk about things that are unpleasant, particularly since most people are shamefully complicit in not just allowing it to happen as an acquiescence kind of thing, but also even advocating it. To me, it reminded me of the historical views of what happened in Nazi Germany, where a lot of, quote, good people were complicit in watching the Jews being put on the trains and even actively threw stones at them. You see it in the movie clips. Good people, okay? The banality of evil, Hannah Arendt. I'm very concerned about, so there's a complacency and also almost a desire to move on as if there's no problems now. Because I agree with you, if I can go on one more sentence, which is that I'm not sure that there is somebody like Donald Trump again. Okay. I mean, this guy is a unique, he's the tough, I said he's the toughest SOB I've ever known. And I'm saying that in a positive way. He's a unique person. He galvanized support. He identifies with the common man. The common man identifies with him. And he's an inspirational figure to a lot of people. And I'm concerned that it's a one-off.
Well, I'll just mention your point about how you're qualifying Trump. I just posted a tweet today. I think it's currently pinned on my feed. It was a post directed to Pierre Poilievre, who had an insurmountable lead in the forthcoming Canadian election. I mean, really like 30 yes. points. And now it has flipped. And so the point of my tweet, and I'll kind of paraphrase it. I said, dear Pierre, you know, here's some unsolicited advice. You could take it or leave it. Truly historical figures are not fence sitters. They don't equivocate. Donald Trump won the presidency twice because he doesn't give an F. I mean, and I put star for the F. Mm-hmm. Elon Musk has achieved what he's achieved because he doesn't give an F. Joe Rogan done what he's done because he doesn't give an F. So real historical figures, whether they are in the evil side of the ledger or the positive side of the ledger, just see a path forward and they just move forward. And in the case of, I hate to say it, but in the case of Poilievre, he's doing the Kamala thing, which is, you know, I won't go on Joe Rogan because the political consultants told me I should and so on. And you're not going to win this way. So I completely agree with you. I mean, Donald Trump is a historical figure like probably no other that we will ever see in our lifetimes. And it's not because I've got Donald Trump posters in my bedroom, right? As a marital, right? I'm Canadian. I truly don't have a dog in this fight. But no one that I can think of has had as much thrown as he has and come out victorious. So that has to be, right? Now, regarding the other issues you're talking about, the banality of evil and the acquiescence and so on. One of my favorite experiments in all of behavioral sciences, in all of psychology, which is saying a lot, there's a lot of research in psychology that's great, is the Solomon-Ash conformity experiments. To your
point. Oh, this is amazing. Yes, I've watched this over and over again. Right?
I mean, and now, so do you mind if I explain it to our...
No, go ahead. Absolutely.
Now, several reasons why, and I've lectured this a million times, I still get goosebumps when I lecture it, because I tell my students, you don't have to do convoluted research for it to be some of the most impactful stuff that anybody could ever do. Because I could explain the structure of this experiment to a 10-year-old, they'll get it, and they'll go, wow, this is unbelievable. That's the magic of Solomon Ash. So here's what Solomon Ash did. I'm going to put three lines on the left. The three lines are very, very different in terms of their length. Like a blind person would see the, you know, the difference between those three lines. And then there's another line here, X. So there are three lines here and one line here. One of these lines is the same length as one of these three. So all I'm going to ask people is to tell me out loud which of these three lines is the same one as this one. Now, again, this is not ambiguous stimuli. It's very, very clear what is the...
Right, it's obvious.
Yes. It's obvious from Mars, it's obvious. But what I'm going to do now is I'm going to test people's capacity to engage in herd-like mentality, to your point about COVID. Yes, yes, okay,
right.
I'm happy to be stuck in a draconian prison for the next 3 years because dear leader said it. I don't care what the evidence is. I am a sheep, right? So meaning Solomon Ash, he brings in 8 people to the lab. The first 7 are Confederates, meaning that they are fake subjects, unbeknownst to the 8th subject, who is a real subject. And so then he's going to randomly allocate who sits where. And I say randomly in quotes because it's not random. The first 7 that are going to give the answer, it's already faked. It's already rigged. And so the first person gives the wrong answer. The second person gives the wrong answer and so on. Now, you'd like to think that anybody who's not blind and has a modicum of a spine would look at the other 7 and say, are you effing insane? What kind of answer are you giving? You can't. But guess what? An astonishing high number of people go, yeah, okay, yes, whatever they said. How could it be? What about your lying eyes? So once you understand Solomon Ash, it really doesn't come as a surprise to you what happened in COVID. Ash already explained it to us 7 decades ago.
Absolutely. And I encourage people to look up. There's a video of that experiment where the first time the real test subject, after listening to all these wrong ones, he says the right answer, although he's uncomfortable. And then very soon thereafter, he starts just simply agreeing with the crowd, even though it's obvious. It's really quite astonishing and frightening, frankly. Yeah. I want to just ask a quick follow-up to that one, and that is, why are some people so acquiescent to that sort of peer pressure, but others are not? I mean, I was stunned. I my personal experience, again, during the task force meetings was I was looking around the room saying, am I the only person that's hearing this stuff? Why am I the only person speaking out against what is clearly inane, illogical, and pseudoscientific statements made by Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx? And I wonder, people have asked me, why am I not like that? Why was I willing to be outspoken? But I'm sort of asking you the opposite question, which is, why are people so, what is this phenomenon of herd mentality, herd thinking, sheep-like behavior? I mean, why are some people immune from it and some people are just happy to go along?
So I'll answer it in 2 ways, both actually very, very informed from an evolutionary perspective. So there was a study that was done now more than, I think, 15 years ago, where they primed people either for survival or for mating. And they gave them one of 2 types of advertising, either what's called a social proofing appeal. Hey, 6 billion peoples have been served and loved it. Shouldn't you also try our burger? So social proofing means everybody's done it. Shouldn't you as well? It's been tested. The other type of appeal is one of scarcity. You know, you're the only one. It's premium. It's newly developed and so on. It turns out that when people are primed for survival, they're much more likely to prefer the social proofing appeal, the one where you are part of the herd, you're moving all in sync. Because when you prime me about survival, I don't want to stick out. I want to be part of the herd. On the other hand, when you prime me about mating, then I do want to stick out. I don't want to be part of the herd so that I can get a chance that you pick me. So that already gives you a sense of the evolutionary dynamics of when it makes sense to be part of the herd and when it makes sense for me to stand up. The second point I'm going to make is that at first it's going to sound as though I'm not answering your question, but I'm going to bring it back. Your more general question is really, why is there a heterogeneity of personality types? That's really your question. Like, why is it that you are a honey badger, Scott Atlas, but all the other people in that room were, you know, castrated cowards? Why? Well, the answer is that evolution would never have chosen for a singular optimal personality type, because depending on the ecosystem, different personality profiles might be the optimal one. So, for example, the fact that we have 10 fingers now, that's called a fixed trait, right? Now, some people are born with a congenital disorder whereby they have 11 fingers or 9 fingers, but the fixed phenotype is set at 10 and selection is no longer working on that problem. But when it comes to personality types, there is an argument to be made for the conditions under which being a herd-like castrated guy would be adaptive, and where it would be adaptive for Scott Atlases to emerge. And therefore, that's why you have a distribution of both. God damn, where is my Nobel Prize? Look at all of these explanations. No, but in all seriousness, you see my point? Like, there is no evolutionary reason why it should be that the world is only inhabited by castrated herd-like people or by only Scott Atlases. And that's why we've got the mix of both types.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of people are happy that the world is inhabited by not just only Scott Atlases. Let's put it that way.
Not your wife, though. She's very happy you exist.
Okay, Gad, it was really a great pleasure chatting with you. And I'm going to have you back again because we never got to the part about how do we fix this. And I think this is part of, again, an extension of your whole work is, what is the solution? How do we make sure we can stop these sort of mind viruses from being so destructive? I don't think the answer is very simple, but we're going to catch up with you again and get a lowdown on that.
I'm available at your leisure. I'll always be happy to come back. Thank you so much, Scott.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for being here, and I'll see you next time.
Cheers. Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to check out more about today's guest, Gad Saad, check out his podcast and YouTube channel, The Saad Truth. That's S-A-A-D. Read his books and watch his interviews. And don't forget, please subscribe to this show on YouTube as well as Spotify, Apple, Google, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now. And I'll see you next time.